Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you click on that Here We Still Stand live stream link, because Here We Still Stand is going worldwide on the internet. Yeah, we had to cancel the in-person event, but we didn't cancel the event. We're going to bring it to everybody for free. So we're going to be live streaming this thing all over the world. All you got to do is sign up. So go over to 1517, click on that banner for Here We Still Stand. You just throw your email address in there and we will email you the link at the appropriate time. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your church. No reason for everybody not to, to join us for Here We Still Stand live October 16th and 17th. So
amen. It's
2 days, Friday and Saturday in October. So we are excited about that. We are working hard right now to develop some awesome stuff that is going to be different than the normal conference would be, because it's live stream. So lots of additional kind of content and conversations going to be going on. So excited about all that. Eric, what's going on, man?
Oh, let's see. What's going on? It's reopening week for me. That's what's going on. I reopened in-person services at Epiphany in Manhattan this last Sunday. And this Sunday, I am hosting or pastoring my church in New Jersey for our reopening here in live in-person. So there's just been a lot of sort of behind-the-scenes work getting ready for that. And lots of conversations that need to happen, lots of organization. You know, it's weird that it would even be a thing, because we've done that always, but hey man, we've been locked up for 5 months and everything's been strictly online, so now we've, you know, got to get back to it. But
yeah,
so excited about that, looking forward to it, and we'll see, you know, what God does with it. But
awesome,
that's what's going on with me. That's like, that's all consuming.
Yes, well, I imagine so.
Yeah,
well, we finished up 1 Corinthians chapter 6 last week, and now we are jumping into 7, and we're going to talk a whole bunch about marriage.
We are. We're going to talk a lot about marriage, about singleness, about, I mean, this is what's happening here is Paul is, you know, continuing to address issues that are coming up in the church's life. Now, so far in the first 6 chapters, he's addressed a number of problems they're having, a number of frankly just sinful tendencies that he's either heard about or that is, you know, a common theme within the congregation. Now he's going to address not maybe so much a matter of sin as he is a misunderstanding about sex and marriage and all of that. And so we pick it up at chapter 7, verse 1. He says, "Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman."
That's
before we go on, very important. Yes, he's quoting them something they wrote him. So the quote is, "It is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman." So there appears to have been, even as we know, on the one hand, that there's sexual immorality happening in the church, there appears to be an opposite response to that, or an opposite action going on too, which is an emphasis on some sort of asceticism when it comes to sexual activity. And there seems to be a narrative, at least from some quarters within the church, that are saying man just shouldn't have sex with woman at all. Like, it just should be forsaken.
Yeah. Yeah. And one thing that is interesting about this that maybe makes it a little bit understandable why someone would maybe think this is that, with the exception of Peter, we don't know of any of the other apostles having wives and families and this stuff. Certainly Paul didn't, who is writing this letter, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you could see a narrative rise that says the people whom God is using most, by and large, have foregone this whole marriage sex thing.
Yeah. And well, so and Jesus himself.
Jesus himself. Yeah. So you could see this way. They were like, you know what? You know what's not helpful is relationships between men and women. So we'll just get rid of that altogether. And Paul's going to say, that might be leading you to some other things that are not ideal.
Yeah, that are problematic. And it's also understandable that they might develop this view considering the cultural background they're coming from, you know, highly idolatrous temple prostitution type culture where, you know, sexuality, we know in the Roman Empire is, you know, pretty it's pretty prevalent. There's a lot of, you know, all sorts of immoral sexual activity going on. And now somebody becomes a Christian and the natural thing is to go, okay, I can't do those things anymore. Who am I going to model my life after? Well, Jesus. And Jesus was single. And this has carried on throughout the church's history, right, Dan? I mean, we have examples of this way of thinking that, like, if you stay single, then you are sort of on the path to a greater holiness than other people. And so, of course, we know with our Roman Catholic friends that they, you know, do not allow priests, if they are going to be ordained, to, you know, engage in sexual activity and to be married, at least at this time. That wasn't always the case in the history of the church, but that is the case and has been for quite some time.
Then you have monks and nuns and...
Yep. And that starts pretty early in the church. I mean, you do have monks and hermits and people like that that are, they're coming up with rules to avoid the, you know, sort of lesser appetites of humanity, to avoid the appetites of the flesh. And so sex is sort of just... sex of any kind in any context is sort of becomes synonymous in some quarters in the early history of the church as just being dirty and bad and not right.
It's associated with ungodliness.
Yeah. And so, yeah, sex as a whole then kind of gets lumped in there at certain times throughout the history of the church. And so Paul is going to correct this misunderstanding that the church has by saying in verse 2, but because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights and likewise the wife to her husband. Now, this is saying what you think it's saying, folks. First, Paul is saying, listen, the problem with you insisting that everybody remain celibate is that they're inevitably going to be prone towards temptation to sexual immorality.
Yeah, the problem with everybody remaining celibate is the vast majority of people aren't built that way.
That's right. And so Paul says each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. Now, this is not an absolute statement or a blanket statement because, as he'll go on to show, even in this passage, he doesn't have his own wife. And so it's not to say that if you're not married, that that's bad. But it's acknowledging that for the majority of people, that's probably going to need to be the case. If for any reason, and there's lots of reasons to get married, but if for any reason, just even at bottom, to avoid the temptation to go have sex with other people.
Well, we saw this in Luther's day when, you know, when Luther traveled to Rome and he was horrified by all the stuff the monks were doing. So you have all these people that are supposedly living these chaste lives, and there was brothels and stuff set up specifically for people in the church, right?
Yes.
For the monks and this kind of stuff. And he was totally freaked out by the whole thing, which you would think would be one of the things besides obviously the scriptures, but just a anecdotal event in his life where he realized that this doesn't really work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so after Paul says, you should, most of you are going to need to get married, he then says very specifically, and when you are married, you should be having sex with each other regularly. That's mm-hmm. essentially, if I can just, you know, sort of speak it in the vernacular that we would speak it when he says the husband should give his wife her conjugal rights and likewise the wife to her husband, that's what he means. And he'll go on to explain that in verse 4. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does.
Now, it's important that he does both of these moves here.
That's right. And by the way, very unique in the ancient world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the wife in the ancient world was property of the husband.
Yeah.
And here, Paul makes the scandalous statement that you're both property of each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you can almost see him saying, the wife doesn't have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And everyone's like, that's right, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
correct. And then he comes in with, likewise, the husband doesn't have authority over his own body, but the wife does. And you're like, wait a minute, I don't know if I want the wife telling me what I can and can't do with my body.
Yeah, and, no, that's exactly right.
Yeah, so this is a very progressive move that Paul is making here.
Yes. I mean, you know, so contrary to the sort of view that one might hear from time to time that, you know, early Christianity was this very, you know, patriarchal movement, et cetera, there's nothing further from the truth. In contrast to the greater culture around the Roman Empire, Christianity was very non-patriarchal and was elevating women in ways that they had not been elevated anywhere else at really any other time.
Yeah. Well, another thing about this too is you might be like, well, wouldn't it be better if you just kind of like said, like, look, every person kind of has, you know, rights over their own body and you know, there's some autonomy there that we need to hold. What Paul does instead is say that marriage is a surrendering over of what used to be strictly yours to another person. Mm-hmm. So marriage is then a giving up of some rights that you certainly possessed previously.
Yes. Yep. That's exactly right. So there's a, you know, there's an equality here to Paul's argument that, you know, since you guys both have ownership over each other's bodies, you guys are self-donating. You are giving to one another when you choose to give to each other in a sexual way. And so he says, verse 5, do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control.
Seems like Paul knows that these people are remaining sinners.
That's indeed correct.
Yeah. So if we're basically, if you're going to, like, you know, go long periods of time without engaging in intimacy, then you should talk about it.
Yeah. And again, it should be a mutually agreed upon thing. One should not sort of withhold in, you know, as a weapon or something like that. And, you know, it's not, it that's breaking down the sort of covenantal sense of the marriage bond. But Paul does say here that there is some freedom, there's some flexibility here, that both partners have to work together in order to determine what's sort of best for them in their marriage. I mean, so on the one hand, he says, don't deprive one another because you're prone to temptation and you could lack self-control if you don't, you know, engage in intimacy, you know, fairly regularly. On the other hand, it's made abundantly clear here, don't be forcing your spouse to do something sexually either.
Yeah.
And sometimes, unfortunately, that has happened. And that has happened within the church, where a man has been made to feel, typically it's been males, the male has been made to feel like he has the right to just tell his wife, you know, whenever he wants to have sex, that she has to submit to that. That doesn't square with what Paul says in verse 4. No, it's a mutually agreed upon thing. Both of you own each other's bodies. And so you have to think and work together in this process.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is all in the context of belonging to one another, loving one another. There should be no domineering or authoritarian kind of setup going on when you're talking about the relationship between a husband and wife.
Yeah, that's right. And it is related also to what we read at the end of chapter 6, because there Paul says, you were bought. He says, you were not your own. You were bought with a price. So glorify God in your body. In the previous passage, he's talking about the fact that God ultimately is the owner of all of your bodies. He's the one who's bought you with his very own body. And now, with that in mind, with the gospel truth that God has taken possession of you, now seek to be that generous giver of your body to one another in the context of marriage.
Yep.
Now he goes on and says in verse 6, now as a concession, not a command, I say this.
This is his way of saying this. This is not, thus saith the Lord. This is something that I think.
Yes, that's right. And he's saying it, I mean, it, you know, as he goes on in verse 7, he says, I wish that all were as I myself am, but each has his own gift from God, one of one kind and one of another. What Paul's referring to there is, of course, his ability to remain single, his celibacy. But he, on the one hand, he says, listen, I think most of you need to be married. Does that mean I think all of you need to be? No. But I do, you know, if I had my druthers, I think a lot could be accomplished in the kingdom of God if all of you were single instead of married. That's true. And yeah. he'll go on to say that more explicitly. Well, yes, I think
well,
that's
I don't
true.
Know if you know this, Eric. When you get married and you, so then you have a wife, and then sometimes that leads to having kids.
That takes some time.
It takes
some resources.
It takes some time, some resources. Paul is acknowledging that, like, I'm doing a lot of stuff that probably I couldn't do if I was toting a family around. This would slow my work down, right?
Yeah.
Does that mean that wife and children are bad? No, it doesn't mean it's bad at all. In fact, both are described as blessings and gifts from God.
That's right.
But that these gifts will not increase your ability to just do whatever you want for the Lord. You have now other responsibilities and other concerns, and now you are raising your family to the glory of God, and you have other obligations that are not opposed to the gospel. They are, in fact, gifts of God. But certainly, you're probably not going to go be a Paul if you got six kids running around.
That's just generally the case. I mean, that there's going to be limits due to your responsibilities as a parent, as a spouse, that will forbid you from doing as much as you could if you were single. And that is true. There's a lot of truth to that. Yeah. I mean, there, because you have to now think about the well-being of all sorts of other people.
Yeah.
Around you. It's not just getting up and going.
I think you see some of this play out with Paul and Peter. Their ministry is very different. And I think the reason that Peter's largely stays in Jerusalem until the end of his life and isn't running all over the place the way Paul is. You don't have the maps in the back of your Bible of the missionary journeys of Peter.
No.
I think the reason for that is that Peter has a family.
I think that's very true. And so that's really Paul's overall point here when he says, I wish that you were as I myself am. But he acknowledges each has his own gift, and so we should be accepting of both realities. Now he moves on to the unmarried, and he says, to the unmarried and the widows, verse 8, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. Okay? But if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. So here's a restating again of the principle he's just gone over. If you can't control yourself, then you should try to get married.
Yep. And this is an interesting, just how practical is Paul right here, where he's just like,
well, this is what I was going to note. Like, there's not a lot of romance to Paul's view of marriage,
no.
Right? I
mean, he's clearly an unmarried guy.
Yeah. He's just like, hey, if you can't stay pure, well, then to avoid impurity, go ahead and find somebody that you can go ahead and have sex with.
Yeah.
And go ahead and marry that person.
Yeah. Paul's not over here saying, if you really just feel like you can't control yourself, you should probably get busy finding your soulmate.
that's not the word he uses, Dan.
No.
So this is very practical stuff here. And he says, verse 10, to the married, I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And the husband should not divorce his wife.
Yeah. Now he has shifted here from, hey, here's some thoughts I have, to, hey, this is direct from God.
Yeah. And all this is simply stating is that God's will for the marriage is that ideally it stay together. Now he will acknowledge, as we go further in this passage, that there will be times where that maybe is not possible. Mm. But he wants them to know the seriousness of the relationship that they're entering into.
Yeah, the idea here is not that nobody ever ends up divorced or that there's no good reasons to be divorced.
Yep.
But that God's goal and will for marriage is that divorce not be what happens.
That's right.
That doesn't mean that God can't work all things together for good, including divorce. The things that God works together for good are necessarily bad things. Now, and people don't usually run around saying divorce is a good thing. It may be a necessary thing in certain circumstances, but you wouldn't say, if it is necessary, you would say it's necessary because of some other bad thing, right?
Yeah.
And so the idea here is not that it doesn't happen, but that it's not how it's supposed to be.
That's right. That's right. It's just, it's not. And that's really the issue here. I mean, and he will go on to give an example of times in which you can't stay married for whatever reason, or you're not able to, or that you have a justification. I do want to point out here again, this is the Christian teaching about marriage did a ton to elevate women, because again, even within the Judaism of the first century, before the time of Christ, basically a husband could divorce his wife. I mean, you have rabbis giving justifications for divorce for things as silly as if she burns your food.
Yeah.
No, you have the right to divorce her.
You see Jesus address this when he says, look, Moses said, hey, you got to give a certificate of divorce. But he did that not because it's a good thing, but because of the hardness of your heart that you were going to bail out anyway. Right.
Yeah.
And so the certificate of divorce meant that you could then be eligible to go marry somebody else. Mm-hmm. But what Paul is doing here is, if you understand the cultural context, is that he is taking that away from men, because women didn't go around divorcing men in this day either. Like that wasn't something that was going on.
Women were almost entirely dependent upon their husband to provide for them. And so they would put up with an awful lot. I mean, even really hard and abusive things, many times not rightly at all, but they had no choice. Yeah. Like they had to depend on that husband. And by the way, if they were sent away with a certificate of divorce, then no other man at that time wanted her, because it was like, oh, she's, this horrible phrase, damaged goods, that was really the perception at the time. And so Paul is doing a ton here in the spirit of Jesus to protect women, to make sure that they're not just thrown, out and left in the cold.
Yep.
So he goes on, verse 12, to the rest I say, I, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. Now, let's just stop there, Dan, because there's some weirdness here, right? I mean, this is...
It's probably good that he prefaces this with, to the rest I say, not the Lord, because what I'm about to say is weird.
Right. It is a strange little set of verses here. At first, it's pretty understandable. I mean, basically, he's telling both spouses, if you have, or each the wife or the husband, whoever's reading this, if you happen to be married to somebody who doesn't believe, don't leave them.
Right.
Stay with them. If they want to stay with you, stay with them. So to convert to Jesus Christ does not mean, well, since my husband or my wife is not a believer, now I guess I can't be married to them anymore.
Yeah. And he acknowledges that that could be something that happens because the other person is unwilling to stay with you because you, again, culturally speaking, this is not hard to understand that in that context, if you decided, hey, I'm going to convert to this outlawed religion.
Yeah.
That your spouse might be like, well, then I'm out because I'm not going down like that.
Or that the husband would see it as an act of rebellion, because remember, the husband really was the one who called the shots when it came to conversion and that kind of.
So the argument here is that if the other party is willing to stay, you should stay.
Mm-hmm. Now, so that's pretty clear, but then you get this verse 14, the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, same thing with the unbelieving wife. And then your children would be unclean if it wasn't so. But as it is, they are holy. What do we make of that, Dan?
Well, the thing about holiness is that holiness is a proximity issue. So we think about holiness as do's and don'ts and morality and this kind of stuff. This is not how it works. God alone is holy. In the Old Testament, you have the holy place. You have the Holy of Holies. And as you like get in closer to God, like that's where holiness is. So holiness is a proximity issue. Christians are holy because they've been baptized into Christ. You can't be any more holy than being baptized into that which is holy. Mm-hmm. And so you have this sort of argument that if you have somebody in a household who is a believer, they are then closer to Christ than they would otherwise be. Now, of course, like spiritually speaking, they're dead in trespasses and sins, but certainly yes. the space is created for an opportunity for them also to be brought in. For the children, this is something that we would understand as God gives you children. God means for Christian parents to raise their children in the faith as yeah. gifts from his hand. And so they are, by virtue of being given to you as a believer, hopefully then you are baptizing them, and they too then are made holy. So they are made holy by virtue of the same way that you were made holy, regardless of whether the spouse is believing or not.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. That this is when we think about the way holy is used here, we should think about it in terms of proximity. We should think about it in terms of influence. You know, that the spouse is definitely going to have an influence that draws the person necessarily potentially closer to the idea of Christianity than if they did not have that spouse. Mm-hmm. And so now he gives his permission for when, well, indeed, separation is valid. He says, but if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife?
Yeah.
So the idea, if we can just sort of, you know, bring it down to brass tacks, Christian, don't divorce your unbelieving spouse. At the same time, Christian, if your unbelieving spouse insists on leaving you, then you're free to allow them to leave you.
Yeah, that you can be at peace with this, as he says. And the idea here is that you also shouldn't feel like you failed, because their salvation at the end of the day is not in your hands.
That's right. And I think that is a big issue for people that have been married to an unbelieving spouse, is that they tend to take that burden upon themselves, you know, that it can be up to them to bring them into the faith. In truth, it's not any more up to you than it, or the burden is no more carried by you than it is for anybody else. I mean, ultimately, it's the Spirit of God working through the means of grace that a person is brought into the kingdom. When that's going to happen, how it's going to happen, well, there's a bit of a mystery there.
Yeah, and the reason you stay is because it very well might be that God is going to use you to bring them to the faith. But this is not a guarantee. And therefore, if this does not happen, you shouldn't feel like you have somehow dropped the ball, because at the end of the day, it is God who saves, not you.
Which, by the way, I have seen happen. I mean, I've seen it happen multiple times and in very different circumstances. I've seen people that have been married to an unbelieving spouse whose spouse, after a few years of being married, comes to the faith as well. I've seen situations where a believing spouse was married for like 50, 60 years to an unbelieving spouse in a deeply loving relationship, by the way. That's another reason you stay. Like, you actually do love your spouse still.
Yeah.
It's not just to convert them. Like, you actually love this person.
Fell in love with Jesus, fell out of love with you. Like, that's not how that's supposed to work.
Yeah, that's not a good thing. And I've seen that happen, where somebody who is, you know, just faithfully, patiently praying for their spouse to become a Christian, you know, using whatever influence they had, and sure enough, their spouse did become a Christian after sometimes decades and decades of marriage. So if you're in that position, Christian, and you have a spouse that still loves you and you love them and is, you know, willing to stay with you, don't give up hope. God is still working through you and through other means to bring about the gospel to that spouse.
Yeah, that's it. And that is it, man. That is time for today. So we will continue on with some similar thoughts next week, and some different stuff as Paul moves along. Guys, if you want to join us for the Here We Still Stand live stream, I will put a link in the show notes. All you got to do is click on that link, that Here We Still Stand live stream link, and sign up. And man, we'd really appreciate it if you would just share that around, because it is free. So throw it on social media, tell your friends, your family, anyone that you think might be interested. Some people that maybe you have been trying to get to listen to kind of the stuff that we've been doing, or you friends that you would have loved to have been there, but they're not going to travel to California to hear a bunch of people that they've never heard of. Well, now they can just sign up, and maybe you get them to watch the free live stream. So link is in the show notes. do it. Eric, I'll see you next week.
Sounds good.